From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we learn why half of Wisconsin's working women have considered quitting their jobs. We'll learn about the work to protect Milwaukee's fresh coast and make sure it remains accessible to all.
Most people call this area flyover country. They're focused on the ocean coast, and they don't even realize that we have the fresh coast.
Dining critic Ann Christensen shares where to find the best comfort food in Milwaukee.
You know, chefs are just like you and me. You know, they have comforts that are not necessarily high-end cuisine. So I just thought that would be a really fun component. It also brings people into the story, which I think is always good.
Plus, we'll tell you about a unique geographical spot right here in Wisconsin. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here's today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. We'll start with new research that reveals half of working women in Wisconsin are considering leaving their current jobs since the pandemic began. That's 25% higher than the national average. The number goes even higher for women working in retail, food service, and hospitality industries. This study by Kane Communications Group is the first of its kind to look into women's outlook regarding their jobs, stress levels, state of well-being, support, and satisfaction. The report also makes recommendations for employers on how to make the workplace better for women. To share some of the main takeaways, I'm joined by Kimberly Kane, President and CEO of Kane Communications, and Jen Dirks, President and CEO of Tempo Milwaukee, a group of nearly 800 executive and emerging women leaders. Kane begins by sharing what prompted the study.
So as our clients started working to bring employees back into their offices this summer, they were seeing the national headlines and the global headlines about the great resignation and about the reluctance of workers, especially women, to want to come back into the office. And they were afraid of saying the wrong things or making the wrong decisions. So we started looking here in the state of Wisconsin to see what kind of local or even regional data there was about the quit rate and specifically about women, because at that time we were seeing that women were really leading that great resignation. We found no local data. And so that's what led us to decide to start the research. We wanted to get a pulse check on how working women in the state of Wisconsin were feeling. And we wanted to get a sense of what does a modern day work environment need to look like to keep women engaged, to retain women in the workforce. So that's what led to our decision to take this study on.
Yeah, one big thing from the study is that 50% of Wisconsin's working women are considering quitting at their current jobs, which is 25% higher than the national average that was recently reported. So what are some of the main driving factors for why Wisconsin women aren't satisfied with their current work situation and consider quitting or moving on somewhere else?
Yeah, that number, Audrey, was a big aha for us. So we wanted to do exactly what you asked. We wanted to dig in and find out what's going on. And when you look at the data across the state, you see there are four main issues going on. Stress levels. So the stress levels of working women in Wisconsin are higher than stress levels of women across the country. Concerns about pay. Working women in the state of Wisconsin continue to be paid far less than men in the state of Wisconsin. Childcare for working mothers continues to be a problem. 81% of the women who have children in our study said they work for employers who don't offer childcare. And the largest reason that women who work in the state of Wisconsin are considering quitting their jobs is because they feel undervalued by their employer. A real disconnect between the value that they believe they bring to the workplace and the value that they perceive their employer sees they bring to the workplace. And the feeling of undervalued, women feeling undervalued in the workplace, isn't new. When you take a look at studies as far back as, say, the Harvard Business Review, the female economy in 2009, you see in that study, women stated that one of their biggest concerns is that they don't feel valued in the workplace. The difference is today, the pandemic redefined our relationship with our employers. So many women were working from home. They were working hybrid schedules. And in addition to often very high expectations from their employers or sometimes no flexibility from their employers, they also became full-time stay-at-home moms and full-time teachers, or they were also caring for members of the family. So they had enormous responsibilities on their shoulders already as working women. But then that was combined with all of these additional factors that all came, you know, onto their shoulders at one time. And women just felt, unfortunately, in too many cases, their employers were not meeting them where they're at, were not listening to how they were feeling. And, you know, we found that, well, 50% of women are considering quitting. They haven't left the workplace entirely. So women are leaving their jobs, but they may be going to work for other employers that help them feel valued. So employers have a chance to meet women where they're at and help them feel valued in the workplace. And that's going to be key, I think, moving forward for Wisconsin employers.
Right. Jen, perhaps you can touch upon this, but as long as we're talking about women, working mothers specifically, you know, it's hard, especially when the federal level doesn't support or set precedents for support or childcare, maternal leave, paternal leave. So what can companies do to fix and address this? Because it's hard when there's no incentive. So how do we drive incentives internally to support working parents?
Yeah, I think studies like this, particularly as well as McKinsey report, I think is really shedding light on there is a challenge, there is an issue here. And this validates that there needs to be, companies need to start peeling back the onion and start looking underneath the hood and saying, what is it that maybe women are leaving in droves from our organizations? What are we doing to keep women here? How are we retaining them? How are we recruiting them? I think that was even a discussion prior to the pandemic, but to Kimberly's point, it has elevated it and it has, you know, further emphasize that we need to look at equity for women in the workplace differently than we did. I mean, there are so many studies out there and national headlines that women were the largest population that the pandemic negatively impacted in terms of leaving the workforce. And so if those headlines aren't enough to cause employers to kind of think differently and start to do things differently, it just has to be done. I mean, there has to be processes and practices put into place.
Well, let's go into what you said, Jen, like if these headlines aren't enough, can you touch upon the risk that employers and the economy will face if women end up quitting in high numbers?
So we did a pulse check 3 months into the pandemic, just checking in with our Temple members. How are you doing? How are you working in this new virtual environment? How's that going? We know you're juggling childcare and your work. How are your employers reacting to that? 3 months in, the report back from our Temple members was, it's working, it's been a challenge, but we're good. Fast forward to 9 months, maybe a year into the pandemic, and the story and the tone was much different. Our women were coming back and saying, I can't do this anymore. My employer is not understanding that I'm juggling so many things, trying to, you know, pivot and experience different things. And you know what? I need to leave. And what does that look like? And so that completely changed the narrative for our Temple members. And in terms of, I've been in my job for 10 to 15 years. Now I have to look at a new career. What does that look like? So it just completely changed. And I think employers run a risk if they are not addressing these issues and not seeing what is happening inside their doors. And if they don't do anything about it, it's going to be a huge risk.
You know what? I've spoken with a few employers just recently since the results of the study came out. And one CEO called me and said, I've never thought about whether my employees feel valued or not. The majority of my workforce are women, and I take it personally. It pains me to think that women who work for my company don't feel valued. On the other hand, I spoke with a CEO last week about the statistics as well, and he essentially folded his arms in front of him and said, listen, everybody has to come back into the office. I'm not making concessions. If I need to meet with some people individually to have special conversations, I will, I'll consider it, but we're going to go back to the way things were before. And unfortunately, he is seeing turnover in his company, and the majority of people who are leaving, guess what, are women.
We also need to talk about the different factors that women of color face in the workplace compared to white women. So what additional systemic barriers do women of color face in the workplace? And what were some key takeaways you learned from getting their feedback for this survey?
The survey statistics around women of color were probably the most heartbreaking for me because, you know, we have as a region been working to prioritize bringing individuals of color into organizations and elevating them into leadership ranks. So the MMAC made a commitment to becoming a region of choice in 2019, I believe. So there has been an emphasis externally on recruitment of individuals of color, but the survey statistics show us there's a disconnect between maybe what we're doing externally and how women of color especially are feeling as employees inside these organizations. So, you know, 29% of the women that we spoke with said they feel undervalued in the workplace, and that's their primary reason for considering quitting. But when you look at women of color, 42% of African-American women say they feel undervalued by their employer, and 29% of Latinas say they actually quit their jobs because they don't feel valued by their employer. And you look closely at the alignment then between kind of what women of color are expecting from their employers when they join a workplace, those values, right? Things that are important to them and what they actually experience. So 63% of African-American women in our study say they do not believe that their values align with their employer's values anymore. And that says to me, employers aren't walking their talk. Those numbers are disturbing on a number of different levels. And again, it's a call to action that I think Wisconsin employers can't just create a program and check a box, you know, put pictures and words on their website. They really have to evaluate what an inclusive work environment actually is.
Yeah, I would agree as well. We, Tempo, has done a great deal of work with our DEI journey. Like many organizations, we are on that journey and kind of educating our members, but also, to Kimberly's point, really being intentional about our approach and making sure that it's just not here is a statement that we're going to put out, but what are the actionable items that we are really, from our membership to our programming, that we are being intentional about to change the narrative and change, you know, how we are advocating for women of color. But, you know, it's beyond the pandemic, beyond this study, women of color or are, when it comes to pay equity, when it comes to advancing into executive leadership roles, they're at a much lower rate and much lower percentage than white women. And so I think just, again, acknowledging that, and then what is our part as employers to change that and to make it, to change that direction and be intentional about it.
The survey also notes that Wisconsin women experience different realities depending on their industry. So what sector has the most work to do?
Two sectors absolutely stand out as having more work to do. One of them is the manufacturing, transportation, energy, and agriculture industry. So we really pulled out what we called sector setbacks. And in these industries we put together, we see stress rates at extremely high levels. So nationally, according to McKinsey, 50% of working women feel stressed. In the state of Wisconsin, we found 68% of working women feel stressed, but that level goes up to 78% of working women in that this manufacturing sector feel very high levels of stress. The other area where we saw some big sector setbacks is in the retail and hospitality industry, where you also see very high levels of stress, and you see big gaps in terms of pay and flexibility. So these two sectors in particular are facing a crisis when it comes to working women and need to begin to be very intentional about evaluating this data and making some changes.
What do you both hope at this research, you know, the first of its kind released in Wisconsin here in 2021, what do you hope it'll bring about or change?
I think Kimberly said it earlier, I think this is an eye-opening study that will really force employers to take a deep look inside what they are doing to attract and retain women.
Tough feedback is very hard to take. And what I hope is that Wisconsin employers who don't want to download this report and read it, do it, because it is eye-opening. And, you know, when we talk about what's best for the economy, Audrey, we have to talk about what's best for women. So if employers want to flip the lights back on, if they want to rev the engines of their businesses, they have to take a look at retaining women, at elevating women in their workplaces. And so I hope that employers download this report. I hope they look at the statistics, and I hope they work with their leadership teams to, you know, have a few aha moments within their own organizations, and then plan to make retaining working women a priority in 2022.
Well, Kimberly and Jen, I want to thank you both so much for joining me today to talk about this very important research, and thank you for doing it.
Thank you so much. Absolutely.
Kimberly Kane is the president and CEO of Kane Communications Group, and Jen Dirks is president and CEO of Tempo of Greater Milwaukee. We spoke last month, and you can find a link to their study at wuwm.com. Do you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? If you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on our show, just search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to us on demand. Wisconsin is home to a significant geographical marker, and we'll tell you all about it and where it is in about 20 minutes. But first, we'll take a break and then learn about the work that's being done to protect Milwaukee's waterways and keep them accessible to all. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee's lakefront is unique. Wisconsin is also unique in that our right to access our waterways is folded into the state's very constitution. Tomorrow, UW-Milwaukee's Center for Water Policy is hosting an event in hopes of educating the public about Milwaukee's fresh coast and the public's rights to access it. Sarah Martinez and Melissa Scanlan are with the Center for Water Policy and the School of Freshwater Sciences. They spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz, ahead of the event.
Most people call this area flyover country. They're focused on the ocean coasts, and they don't even realize that we have the fresh coast, which is a natural asset that we in Milwaukee, of course, all know about. And what we're trying to do is raise awareness about protecting that fresh coast and making sure it is a draw, not only for the people who live here, but for tourists to come to this area and enjoy it.
Talk about our lake and river spans, and how much was water for centuries and how much has been filled in?
At least in Milwaukee, large portions of the lakefront, if not most of it, is lakebed fill. I mean, things as far up as Bradford Beach and as far south as Jones Island are, at least to my knowledge, all mostly lakebed fill. Summerfest, Bradford Beach, Lakeshore State Park, all of that is lakebed fill. Even parts of Lincoln Memorial Drive, which everybody drives, or not everybody, but most people drive on their way to work, is also built on lakebed fill.
Yeah, part of the focus of our educational event is to hear from John Gerda, the historian, to talk about how the coastline has been transformed over time. And so areas that we look at now and we consider just part of our built environment, like Bradford Beach and the Lincoln Memorial Drive, he will be able to explain how that once had water over it and how that shoreline has changed over time.
So part of the reason, Sarah, I believe, for this conference is to better inform people, to engage people in the conversation, because I think each of your panelists, the people who will be presenting for your program, come at it from a different perspective. As you said, John Gerda has a wealth of historical knowledge. But is the crux of it, what does belong to the public, what should, and how should those areas be used? And I'm guessing, especially in an urban area such as ours, and more people gravitating to water, that those conflicts can get a little bit dicey.
So in all cases of lake bed fill, there's sort of two layers to it. There's the lake bed grant, which specifies the purposes for which that lake bed will be used and filled. For instance, the ones given to the state or given to the city to make Lincoln Memorial Drive and Bradford Beach were given for those purposes. And then another layer on top of that is the public trust doctrine. So the lake bed grants serve sort of one layer, and then you have the public trust doctrine, which on top of that has to preserve or has to promote Wisconsinites' rights to water because the state serves as trustee. So this includes rights to navigation, recreation, water quality, enjoyment of scenic beauty. As long as it meets a couple of those things, it will satisfy the public trust doctrine.
How does this factor into the state's constitution? And really, Sarah, we're throwing a lot at you because you come from a different part of the country, but you've done a lot of research. So how does this Wisconsin's constitution factor into this discussion?
So yeah, Wisconsin is interesting. The public trust doctrine is grounded in Wisconsin's constitution, Article 9, Section 1, and it provides that the state is trustee of the water. And Wisconsin is interesting because it built on top of that through its case law over time, preserving different rights for Wisconsinites. At first it was navigation and then water-based commerce, floating logs to market, I believe was the issue in one case. And it's just grown since then. So Wisconsin is kind of a haven in terms of public trust issues.
I think for some people, I would be one of them who have heard about this program, instantly think of another area along Lake Michigan, Bradford Beach, because there's been conversation about what about that beach and how should any buildings on it be used and so forth. But you're taking us south along the lakeshore off of the area of concern, correct, where major cleanup to remove contaminants that have been there for decades, right?
Yeah, the Milwaukee Estuary Area of Concern is an EPA designated area where there's been legacy contamination. The Area of Concern encompasses roughly 10 miles of river on Milwaukee, Menominee, and Kinnickinnick rivers, as well as parts of the inner and outer harbor of Lake Michigan. And over the next couple of years, the Army Corps and a number of other stakeholders, including Wisconsin DNR and MMSD, will be partnering to dredge all of that material, and then they have to put it somewhere, right? So years and years ago, the early 1900s, there were three legislative lake bed grants given to the city of Milwaukee to create the port. And so as part of that, the city has decided or is deciding, as well as other stakeholders, including Wisconsin DNR, MMSD, those people are deciding whether or not to place this facility over there. And so that's kind of where we come in, where I've been doing a lot of policy analysis around what the law says on this, what the lake bed grants will allow, and how this can really be used as an opportunity to empower the community to give in some valuable input on what they want to see on their lakefront and how we can increase access to Lake Michigan.
And one of the questions that our event is going to be talking about is what could the future land use be on this newly created land? How public should it be? What's the role of the public in deciding what that new land use should be, and when should it be decided? The decisions that municipal leaders made sometimes 100 years ago to turn the lake bed grant area into public parks, consistent with what the state legislature wanted, has now created this greenway throughout the city of Milwaukee that ends when we get to our city borders. And this next opportunity with the area of concern cleanup is another chance for the municipal leaders of today to make those decisions that are going to have a ripple effect 100 years from now and beyond. And so at this educational forum, we want to talk about that whole picture. And we have people coming from the DNR, from the NGO communities, from our academics, academic community to provide that fuller picture and start that dialogue going in the public so that community leaders can make well-informed decisions that are really protecting the public interest going not just for today, but for 50 years from now, 100 years from now, 200 years from now.
Melissa Scanlan is the director of the Center for Water Policy and a professor at UW-Milwaukee's School of Freshwater Sciences. Sarah Martinez is a water policy specialist. They both spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz. For many people, finding and maintaining a sense of community has been tough during the COVID-19 pandemic. Events have been canceled, meeting spaces closed, and art events and groups disbanded. But some are figuring out ways to stay connected. Charlene Smith is an enrolled member of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. She's also a retired nurse, grandmother, mother, and sister. She describes herself as a friend to all people. Smith spoke to WUWM's Mayan Silver about staving off loneliness and isolation for this week's Pandemic Reflections.
In ordinary times, Charlene Smith is what you would call a hugger.
I'm a real huggy kind of person. I have a feeling when I go to hug somebody, I come at them with all of these good feelings, you know, of healing and warmth and love. I try to pass that on to the other person. And I've had compliments, you know, from folks like, oh, man, that hug was good. You know, it felt nice.
But COVID has changed all that.
Now it's just kind of like an elbow bump or a virtual hug, an air hug. People understand that.
Smith is an enrolled member of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin, one of Wisconsin's 11 sovereign nations. She says Milwaukee is a cross-section of all of them. She describes how the pandemic has affected her community.
I mean, we all are social animals, you know, that we definitely like to be out and about. You know, if it's at an elder gathering, you know, playing bingo, or we're at a community gathering for a powwow, there's a lot of those that have been canceled because of the pandemic. You know, people are doing things virtual, you know, which is real different to attend a virtual powwow, you know.
That's forced Smith and others to adapt.
I belong to an Oneida prayer singing group, and we haven't been able to meet either. But I had a friend who was in a hospital, and I took out my songbook, and I sang her a song over the phone. She thought, Charlene, that was so nice. I feel so much better, you know, just to hear somebody singing to me, you know, and I don't have the best voice, but I did okay, you know, that time. When I tell people, you know, that I'll keep them in prayer, or I'll pray for them, or I'll send them a text, people are very much appreciative.
Before the pandemic, when someone was ill, the prayer circle group would gather around and put their hands on the person, as well as each other.
And then all of that prayer energy goes to that person, you know, so be it for healing, for whatever reason, you know, mental, emotional, physical, you know, whatever kind of, you know, trying to deal with issues of an addiction, or just troubling times, you know. So that could be the in-person kind of prayer circle that would occur.
Smith says stopping those circles because of the pandemic has left a kind of void, an absence of camaraderie and sending spiritual strength to each other. So Smith wants to bring their intertribal prayer singing group to the doors of people laid up at home.
My idea was, why don't we do a serenade, like us able-bodied people, you know, go and sing at their doorstep. You know, let's everybody bring out your books and let's sing together. You know, they can open their door and sit by the door, and we can sing together that way.
The group includes members of the Oneida, Menominee, Apache, and other nations. And throughout the pandemic, when people have been able to gather safely outdoors, Smith has turned to another tradition for comfort. It's called smudging, which Smith describes as like a blessing with smoke. Smokes can have the four sacred ingredients: cedars, sage, sweetgrass, and tobacco.
And so they'll make up like a little fire of that and use the eagle feather and send that smoke over your body. And you take that smoke and you wash yourself off, you know. And some people will take and put that smoke to one part of their body because that's where they hurt the most or that's where they want healing the most, you know. So smudging is good.
Smith says smudging is aromatic and has a spirit lifting effect.
You know, people just love the fragrance, you know, of a smudge. And I know it really lightens the spirit around people too. They feel like they've been blessed.
Smith is counting another blessing, that she's living together with her sister for the first time in 50 years. And the two of them know how to keep busy.
And for us, beadwork, doing any kind of craft, you know, that is an outlet for sure. And so if we can help somebody else, we'll make up a quantity of items, you know, and donate it to another function. And we feel good for that then, you know, to see our items out there and somebody else is getting the pleasure, the enjoyment of receiving that gift. So we like to do that.
What does your beadwork look like?
I have a pair of earrings that I beaded, just real simple, but it matches, the colors match my necklace. And my necklace is my medicine. The colors on here represent the four nations, you know, of people, four races. It represents directions. It represents the elements of the world. I have white on top. That's kind of like the snows of the north. And then to the east and west are yellow and red. And yellow is the rising sun. West is the setting sun. And the black is just like a combination of all of that.
Smith and her sister do bead stitching and loom work and also like to play word games on their phone. During these tough times, she's been joining virtual wellness groups offered by the American Indian Council, which offers yoga and other activities. She stays in touch with family and friends by text, email, phone calls, and even snail mail.
Yeah, everybody likes getting mail. I say that all the time. And with our Indian Council for the Elderly group, that one year, somebody said, you must have writer's cramp by now. I said, no, but I personalized each card. And then I gave it to the director. And so she put it in with all of their meals that were being, you know, either meals on wheels or somebody would come and pick up a meal. They all got a Christmas card.
Smith says people talking to each other is really a lifesaver.
People have to air out their concerns to one another, you know, and knowing that they're not alone in this and they're not the only one that feels this. But that's the way you get to feel sometimes in that isolation.
Throughout this pandemic, Smith has exemplified the message that physical distancing does not have to mean social distancing. Maayan Silver, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Charlene Smith is an enrolled member of the Oneida Nation, and she spoke to WUWM's Maayan Silver for our Pandemic Reflection series. You can find more of those conversations at WUWM.com. Next, dining critic Ann Christensen shares where to find the best fish fry, enchiladas, and more comfort foods here in Milwaukee. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Mac and cheese, breakfast for dinner, casseroles, crullers. Ooh, we all have foods that stick to our bones and bring us comfort, especially during the winter. If you're looking for recommendations on where to indulge in comfort foods found in the Milwaukee area, Milwaukee Magazine dining critic Ann Christensen wrote all about it in her article, Food for the Soul. Ann Christensen, welcome back to Lake Effect. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me, Audrey.
So I think we all have an idea of what we like about comfort food, but what is Milwaukee comfort food to you? Is it distinguishable?
In some ways, I think there are universals. Mac and cheese, anything fried, like fried chicken, potatoes, hot cereals, pizza. I mean, those are kind of like universal comfort foods, I think, for a lot of people. But I think there are some Milwaukee ones that are kind of influenced by some of our ethnic heritage. So I talk a little bit in the story about, a very little bit actually, about German cuisine. I guess schnitzel is one of the things that I use as an example.
Right. You say the schnitzel in all its forms is to me the epitome of the kind of eating you'd gladly loosen your belt for. I love that line.
Yeah. Yeah, it's exactly right. But so I think that there's, there's definitely some Milwaukee comfort foods, but I think it's really, really universal. But, you know, at the same time, and I think this comes across in the story, this is such a nostalgic food story. So it's also so based on your individual, what is comfort food for you? What did you have as a kid? What did you have growing up? It's so much a part of what becomes comfort for you. Absolutely. It takes you back to a time when you felt safe or warm, protected, all those types of feelings.
Now, I know you've written a lot of articles and tried a lot of food here in the Milwaukee area. So for this comfort food one in particular, did you already have a few standout dishes in mind? And how much did you need to reacquaint or explore new restaurants or dishes for this?
That's a really good question. I found that I could jump into this really easily because of going out to so many different types of places. You know, mac and cheese being just one example. Immediately, I thought of Honey Pie because they just have an amazing mac and cheese there. Also, I go to quite a lot of Mexican restaurants and Mexican food, you know, enchiladas, pozole, some of those just really warm, comforting Mexican dishes just popped into my head. So I didn't find it difficult to really jump into this. It felt so natural to me.
One of the other food categories you highlight in the nature of comfort food is fish fries. And I think it says a lot about a place and how much we love fish fries in Milwaukee, and that a lot of restaurants offer it outside of Fridays, right? Like, so if you're really hankering for it, you can find it somewhere. So what's one or two of the best fish fry places you recommend?
Well, one of the classic places for me is this beer bar in Oak Creek called Irv's Mug. And they just do a fantastic job with their fish fry. And to me, it's really classic because you can get the potato pancakes and the applesauce and the marble rye bread along with your fried fish, your tartar sauce, your fresh tartar sauce. That to me is just a classic fish fry. A lot of people ask me, well, where can I get perch? I really want a perch fry. That's a very Milwaukee type of thing, you know? And one of the places that I've found that has a really great, this is panko breaded perch, is Tess. It's basically a place you may not think about for fish fries. They're known for their kind of new American style cuisine on the east side, but they do a really great panko breaded perch. And it comes with an Asian inspired coleslaw. It's a little bit different. So they kind of mix it up and they kind of modernize it a little bit, which I like. And, because I think, there's so much history to fish fries, but there's definitely a place to bring in some more different types of ethnicities, you know, less of an old world take on it, more of a new world take on it, which I love seeing. And Tess has that kind of take.
Another kind of food that is synonymous with comfort is soul food. And you highlight Mr. Perkins' family restaurant in this piece, especially.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Perkins is, I think it's probably the top place in town to get soul food. I mean, it's been around for decades. Their recipes, their dishes are so well known. Their fried catfish, their peach cobbler. I mean, these are certain things that people just go back to again and again. There's such history there and such heart. They put such heart and soul into their food. Again, I thought that they deserved really a story too, sort of telling who are they? Where did they come from? How did they start doing this? How did they get into this business? So we tell a little bit more than just soul food there. It's a story about a family.
Now, in the Midwest, we, of course, have to talk about casserole and how much it reigns supreme. So you have some interesting spins on casserole in this, including a recipe from a local chef, kind of offering a different take with some leftover turkey that you can make. But you also talk about its kind of origins from Europe as well. Can you share a little more about that?
Casserole is, you know, it's such an interesting thing for me because I grew up eating casseroles and my mom made them. They were something that I think in the 1970s and 80s were just really, really big. You know, more convenience foods became really popular. And this idea of getting all your food groups into the same dish, you've got your starch, you've got your protein, you've got your vegetable maybe, and then that could be peas or corn, something like that. But I think what's interesting is that people don't realize there is a, you know, sort of a history to that. The word casserole has some French origin, casa, which means pan, and that's in the Provençal dialect. And when you think of different casseroles or different dishes from various countries, you might not even necessarily think of them as casseroles. Like for instance, in Spain, they have paella, which is a seafood and rice dish, but it really is kind of a casserole because anything sort of cooked in the same vessel all together is really a casserole. So I found that to be really fascinating. You know, growing up on what I thought was an American dish is really more than that. It has a lot of history and it has an equivalent in so many different countries. And I also think that the casserole is kind of coming back. Not that it's gone anywhere. It's like one of those things that home cooks kind of fall back on. I mean, some people might think of lasagna as a casserole. It kind of is. But I think especially as things get more tense and more uncertain in the world, we turn to these things. Food is very much a comfort. And I think we're eating more casseroles, Audrey. I really think so. So I just think it's interesting that there is such a history to them and they've sort of led us through or taken us through so many different things in our history.
One other thing you have fun with in this article is asking other local chefs what their comfort food is. What inspired you to do this and how much fun did you have with that?
One of the reasons I thought it would be really fun to ask chefs is I had a feeling that their comfort food would not likely be the food that they cook in their restaurant every day. It would be something that would be much simpler. Plus, I just really love talking to chefs about food. It's really fun. So I wasn't surprised to find out, like, for instance, Dane Baldwin, who owns The Diplomat, pizza for him. I mean, obviously, I've mentioned it before. It's a really common comfort food. But even for him, a frozen pizza, again, that is not unusual with chefs, though, you know, for them to make a frozen pizza late in the evening on their shift, you know, that's what they have time to eat, but they also really like it. They might doctor it up, but they really like it. So, you know, chefs are just like you and me, you know, they have comforts that are not necessarily high-end cuisine. So I just thought that would be a really fun component. It also brings people into the story, which I think is always good.
Well, the piece is certainly really great. It certainly inspires me to go out and get some of these foods for sure. So, Anne, I want to thank you so much for joining me to talk about it today.
Thanks, Audrey.
Anne Christensen is the dining critic for Milwaukee Magazine, and her article on comfort food can be found in the December issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Did you know the center of the Northwest Hemisphere is right here in Wisconsin? Not only that, but of the four spots like it in the world, it's the only one that you can actually travel to. At exactly 45 degrees north latitude and 90 degrees west longitude, in Marathon County, there's a marker identifying the spot. So what's the significance of the center of the Northwest Hemisphere? According to Ryan Holyfield, a geography professor at UW-Milwaukee, it can affect things like the weather. Lake Effect's Beck Andrew Salgado sat down with him to learn more.
So it's basically the point that's halfway, right in the middle of the Western Hemisphere and right in the middle of the northern hemisphere. So where those two lines meet would be the most basic definition. What I would want to say is that on the one hand, I want to be really clear that this is a totally cool spot, and it's a fantastic opportunity to take a selfie and to learn about latitude and longitude. And it's also one of the things that makes this point special is there are only four of these in the world. There are only four of these sort of midpoints. This is the only one you can actually get to easily.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, the one that's in the southern hemisphere, and where the southern and the western hemisphere center is in the South Pacific Ocean.
Okay.
Then if you looked at the eastern hemisphere, the southern one is in the Indian Ocean. And then the northern one is up, it's in a remote part of northern China, not too far from the western edge of the Gobi Desert. And I don't think there's any kind of marker that you can go and visit and take a selfie for. It'd be very hard to get. Now, all that said, what I want to say is that, well, we shouldn't get too excited because the significance of the number might be less than we think it is at first. Gotcha. Now, so like I said, with latitudes more significant than longitude in many ways, because it is tied closely to the axis of the Earth's rotation.
Gotcha.
So the equator and the poles, and then all those, I think of them as rungs of a ladder in between the equator and the poles. Those are tied, those are directly related to how much incoming solar radiation we get.
Mm-hmm.
So as you might imagine, the highest levels of incoming solar radiation are at the equator. And then the lowest are at the poles. So we're halfway between those. We have basically something like half of the amount of incoming solar radiation.
How does this play into, because you did talk about solar radiation a little bit, the weather that is very common in Wisconsin, as we talked about earlier, which tends to get very cold?
Well, that is a good question. It's also a really complex one.
Okay.
That I would have to get into. We're in the mid latitudes. And so one of the things that we know about the mid latitudes is that if we want to know what weather's coming, we tend to look towards the west, because that's where the weather's coming in. And that's not going to be true everywhere in the world. And now the reason for that is, again, closely related to latitudes, the way that prevailing winds, are they going to be going from west to east or east to west? Well, that has to do with latitude. It also has to do with the rotation of the Earth. Basically, what we need to know is we're in the mid-latitudes. We're going to be looking to the west to see what the prevailing winds are going to be bringing us.
Yeah.
But in terms of a couple of other things that you could note is that our weather is not going to be affected, at least in that part of Wisconsin, it's not going to have the same kinds of effects that, say, the ocean would have on the Pacific coast. So the climate in the Pacific coast at this very same latitude, quite different. Or, say, along the coast of Europe, it's going to be quite different. There are other things like ocean currents come into play when you consider that.
Yeah.
Also, if you have mountains, that's going to change your climate too. So Wisconsin, we have kind of what you'd expect to find at 45 degrees latitude with not as many, we don't have the influences of ocean currents or mountains that complicate it too much.
I did read one article and it said that the exact centralized spot that where the podium is or where the marker is, it isn't the exact center anymore. And that is because of the shape of the Earth. And I wanted to ask if you had anything to add to that.
Yeah, well, it's probably referring, I'm guessing, to the slight flattening at the poles. So that basically the site where the plaque is theoretically where that 45, so if you think in terms of just sheer angular distance, so that all these are really angular distance between an equator and a perfectly spherical Earth with the pole, then it would be in the right spot. Mm-hmm. When you got that flattening of the poles, I believe in terms of mileage, the true center would be about 9 miles north of there. So, yeah, you know, I think we can be satisfied with a marker at the theoretical.
Yeah, I mean, I know I certainly am.
Ryan Holyfield is an associate professor of geography and urban studies at UW-Milwaukee. He spoke to Lake Effect's Beck Andrew Salgado. And that wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. New research found direct correlation between COVID-19 misinformation on social media and infection rates. We'll explore that more tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.